Agile brand.
While entrepreneurs are often lauded with creating new businesses and ideas, it is more often the case that change agents working within organizations or intrapreneurs are responsible for innovation and seeing those new ideas through to completion. Welcome to the Innovation Economy Intrapreneurs Series. I am your co-host, Adam Chen, an independent change management consultant and current president of AmenityLink, a property technology company. In this series, you will hear stories and insights from leaders within organizations that have had the courage to create new ways to move business forward. To listen to the latest episodes or sign up for the Innovation Economy newsletter, go to innovationeconomy.show or click on your favorite podcast app to make sure you hear the latest episodes. And now, on to the show. Welcome to the show. I am extremely excited to have our guest on today. We have a very rich discussion to have, but allow me to introduce Robin Bolton. She is the founder of a company called Mile Zero. Welcome to the show, Robin. I'm wondering if you could start by just, you know, telling our listeners a little bit about your journey and, you know, how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. I'm super excited to be here. So, like you said, I'm the founder of Mile Zero, which is a consultancy that works with medium and large companies to help them help their leaders to confidently and repeatedly use innovation to grow their businesses. And it has been a long and winding road to get to that point. You know, I started my career, and one of the reasons I'm so excited to talk to you and to your listeners is I started my career as an entrepreneur. Long enough ago that I don't think the term had, if it had been coined, it was still early days of being an actual term. But I started my career as an entrepreneur working at Procter & Gamble, was hired in, you know, into their marketing function, and by pure luck was put on an innovation team. What we were working on still had a code name, but now everybody knows it as Swiffer. So, you know, got to work on the launch of Swiffer, worked on the launch of Swiffer WetJet, and, you know, had the amazing adventure and bear all the scars of being an entrepreneur and trying to innovate in a big company. So did that for many years. Then, things happen, life transpires, ended up working in consulting after getting my MBA, and then worked at a consulting firm founded by Clayton Christensen, and a father of disruptive innovation, wrote The Innovator's Dilemma, and spent about 9 years there of like really getting immersed deeply in working with companies of all kinds to try to innovate, to avoid disruption. And there's still so much work to be done that's really what led me to found Mile Zero and really focus on helping leaders to navigate all the disruption and the demands for growth that they face today.
That's great. That's you've had some very fortunate, I think, some happenings.
Oh, yeah.
To get luck. There's always an element of luck too, I suppose. But well, for our listeners, you know, I'd love to share how we were first introduced. So I believe one of your colleagues actually is a listener of our show, and she made the connection. And you know, when I quickly checked out your website, one of the, you know, things that struck me was obviously the alignment of subject matter, but also, you know, you have your title, which is founder, but there's another piece of your title called Chief Navigator. And that really struck me. So I'm curious if you wanted to maybe just share a few thoughts on, you know, that choice.
Yeah. One of the joys of having your own company is you can make up your own title. And it's one of the benefits, I guess. So as I thought about what I do and how I work with clients, I realized that really how we work together, because I work very collaboratively with clients, is that I'm next to them. Like, they have to drive. They have to lead. I mean, it's the company they're working in. It's their company. And I'm there to support them, to help them, and to guide the way. And, you know, as anyone who has ever been on a road trip, even if you do all the work ahead of time, you have the map and all that stuff, there's always detours. And having a navigator there to help you figure out what to do when you hit, you know, a road closed or, you know, the need for a detour is really, really helpful. So that's really what I see my role is sitting alongside the leader and helping them navigate from where they are today to where they want to go and get around all of the roadblocks that they hit along the way.
I like that. So maybe said, or, you know, repeating back my understanding. So it's almost like the concept of the owner of the innovation and the idea, it still has to be the business leader, whoever that might be. But you have a very unique vantage point. I think, you know, we're obviously often leaders in businesses. You're, you know, a bit maybe blind, you know, or you're sitting within it. So it's hard to see it at a different perspective. And that's really the benefit that you're able to provide in collaboration with innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've worked across a lot of different industries, so I can bring that in to be like, you know, we saw a similar problem over here and this is how we addressed it. You know, maybe that could work here. And, you know, the other part of my job is, as any good navigator, kind of like, it's okay. People have been lost before. We'll be found. Don't worry. And reassuring. It's okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know for me, in my experience, sometimes that is the, you know, impetus for a lot of innovation is taking these concepts, you know, that might have worked in a completely different arena and applying it in a new way. So that's that breadth of experience that you have, certainly I could see, is very valuable. So digging into that a little bit more, you introduced yourself as, you know, you started your career as an entrepreneur, maybe before it was called such. But now, obviously, you are an entrepreneur. You started your own business and obviously work side by side probably with quite a few entrepreneurs. So I'm curious, from your seat and your experience, you know, how you might differentiate those two concepts.
It's a great question. So I will say, having been both an entrepreneur and an entrepreneur, I think being an entrepreneur is harder, which is not to say that being an entrepreneur is easy. Being an entrepreneur is hard. And as you know, I've learned, as, you know, founding my own company, at first I was like, how hard can this really be? Like, there's so many books and all these resources out there to start a company. Like, it's not that hard. Well, intellectually, it's not that hard, but emotionally, the ups and downs of business are really challenging. And, you know, of course, then you get into capital markets and fundraising and all that stuff. So being an entrepreneur is hard. Being an intrapreneur, in my mind, is even harder, because on top of everything, you have this whole organization that you're working within that in almost every way is designed to stop you. And, you know, it's not designed to stop you because they hate you and they don't want innovation. It's designed so that the company can keep doing what it's doing better, faster, cheaper. So it's designed for efficiency. And as an entrepreneur and working on innovation, you are the definition of everything that is not efficient. And that adds this extra layer of challenge, which is just really, really hard.
That's interesting. So it's a great segue, I think, to some of the things I wanted to talk about disruption and disruptive technologies. You know, and you're talking about, you know, these organizations that are designed to prevent that kind of stuff. So what are, in your experience, some of the biggest blockers to innovation within organizations?
A lot of organizations, if you ask them, will tell you, you know, ideas. We don't have enough creative ideas. We don't have big enough ideas. And that may be a problem, but I will tell you that the single biggest challenge to innovation in an existing organization is leadership. And I say that with love, because being a leader, being an executive, is really hard work. But every company I've ever worked for, worked with, is filled with ideas. And it's filled with people passionate about those ideas. And leaders who often genuinely want to support innovation and entrepreneurs, but they can't because they make very logical decisions. And those logical decisions are driven by, you know, what are your metrics? How are you evaluated in your job? What is your bonus based on? And all of that stuff is short term. And so leaders, executives, managers, they know, you know, if they spend a dollar or allocate a person, to innovation. They don't know what they're going to get back, if anything. And if they do get something back, they don't know when they'll get it back. But if they allocate that person or that dollar to their existing business, they know exactly what they'll get back and when. Mm-hmm. And when your job, when your promotion, when your bonus is all based on delivering the quarter or the year, any one of us would take the sure thing. And that tends to be the barrier within the organization.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So everything's designed for these short-term gains, you know, or the, yeah, the iterative continuous improvement, you know, so you can show that track record. But disruption is inherently not that, right? Disruption is embarking on a completely different path that maybe even might cannibalize your existing business rather than, you know, iteratively improve that business. So like, I guess for our listeners, I'm curious if maybe you can share a story or a case study of this happening. I know what comes to my mind listening to you, you know, I think a common thing that many people know about is like Kodak, right? Kodak is the inventor of the digital camera, yet, you know, who's the major players today in that industry? It's Canon and Nikon, who at that time were the upstarts that usurped, you know, Kodak. Yeah. And so maybe, right, and I obviously wasn't in those rooms and those meetings, but they have the IP. But you're saying it's really a leadership decision. It was a conscious decision of the leaders at Kodak at that time to not promote that side of the business to protect the film business and their revenue. So do you have any other examples or things that you see maybe in your world that take a similar look at companies maybe being a little bit blind?
I think there's, unfortunately, history is kind of littered with them, because you also have Blockbuster and BlackBerry and some of those things. I think one of the interesting, more recent ones, and I don't want to say they're getting disrupted, but I think it was Hertz's decision to get rid of all the electric cars in their fleet.
I just read that, yeah.
And, you know, very good business decisions for that. You know, you hear about customers coming up, they don't want an electric car, but that's all that's available to rent. And then you lead to bad customer experience. You know, they're incredibly expensive to maintain. So, like, again, totally logical decisions for why Hertz would get rid of their electric cars. But it also kind of feels like baby out with the bathwater a little bit of like, is your only choice keep all of them or get rid of all them? Or is there a way to kind of more strategically maintain a fleet in certain places until the electric car, until the infrastructure reaches critical mass? You know, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. So I think it's, you know, we don't have an answer to how the story ends, but it was a decision that when I saw it was so drastic, then I'm like, ooh, this is interesting. This could play out in an extreme way.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating. We're seeing it happen in real time. You know, clarity is always easy when you're looking back and reflecting, but to see it happening in real time, I'm curious to see how it plays out. You know, I was reading another article about Toyota and electric vehicles even recently, and they, I think, have notoriously been late to the game, I think, when it comes to full electronic or, you know, electric vehicles. But at the same time, I also read a separate article about innovation in battery technology, where now they have, you know, a proof of concept that can go 700 plus miles, right? So Apple is another one that's, you know, kind of let the dust settle a little bit before they enter a new market. So it's maybe hurts,
of course, with their
in inverse.
With their Vision Pro, which, you know, they aren't the first to come out with the VR headset, but, you know, they just came out with the Vision Pro, and it's hilarious reading the reviews of, you know, I think people are saying they can only wear it for 15 minutes before their neck gives out because it's so heavy. And one of the first accessories that a third party has come out with is a holster for the extra battery. You know, but I can also say that, you know, we'll see that in probably 10, 15 years, maybe it'll be the norm. So things happen slow than fast, but there are little indicators of, you know, kind of what Apple does of watch what's going on and then pick your moment.
Sure, sure. Yeah, because especially with some of that augmented reality stuff, it could usurp their cell phone business, which is the biggest moneymaker in history, probably, of any product line.
Right.
So yeah, that's fascinating. So I guess circling back, you know, you hit on, you know, leadership ultimately. Mm-hmm. But at Mile Zero, you have this thing that you're calling like the ABCs. So I'm wondering if you can maybe explain that a little bit from Mile Zero's perspective or your perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things, as you can imagine, that has always kind of, I don't want to say bothered me, but it's been a question I've struggled to answer is, innovation has been out there, talked about, a discipline, you know, an investment, all this stuff for decades now. You know, I think the Innovator's Dilemma came out in 1997. And there have been some successes. But for the most part, the success rate of corporate innovation hasn't changed, despite the fact that we have decades of experience talking about it, studying it, et cetera. And so why is that? And, you know, I'm not going to claim that I have the answer. But one of the things I have noticed is that we tend to, and we being, you know, consultants, experts, academics, and entrepreneurs, tend to talk about corporate innovation kind of in silos of like, oh, you know, there's a process or there's a structure, or, you know, we need a training program or we need a culture of innovation. And the fact is you need all those things. And so the ABCs stand for architecture, behavior, and culture. And all three of those things need to be worked on and developed and evolved at the same time, but in different ways, kind of over the course of the critical first 3 years of an innovation team. And so, yes, the architecture, the, you know, strategy, process, structure, metrics, all that's super important. That is where I have spent the vast majority of my career. Hmm. Necessary, but not sufficient for successful innovation. You also need behaviors and the leadership behaviors. And leaders need to engage in different ways with an innovation team than they do with their core business. So you need those things working together. And you need a culture around that within the organization that ideally is super supportive, but at the very least doesn't hinder or get in the way of innovation. Mm-hmm. You kind of need it neutral to supportive. So you really have to be monitoring all three of those things at any given time to have a chance of getting mm-hmm. to that point where innovation is repeatable, sustainable, where you can have confidence in it.
I hope you're enjoying the first part of the show, and I want to invite you to check out another podcast from the Agile brand. It's called B2B Agility, and it's hosted by me, Greg Kilstrom. The B2B Agility podcast looks at the factors that drive success in B2B marketing, with a focus on the people, processes, data, and platforms that make B2B brands stand out and thrive in a competitive marketplace. You can find B2B Agility on this podcast platform or wherever you normally listen. Before we get back to the show, I just wanted to remind you to hit the follow or subscribe button on your app to make sure you get notified when new episodes of the show are available. Now let's get back to the show.
So in your engagements, are you working with the same leadership team on all three of those elements, or do you end up, you know, kind of working with individual groups on and prioritizing certain things with certain people?
We always start at different points. Okay. You know, every team kind of comes in with a different immediate need. And a lot of times, you know, to be fair, teams, the first thing people gravitate to, understandably in business, all left brain thinkers, is we need a process or, you know, we need a structure. And so it's a perfectly fine place to start. You know, there's nothing wrong with starting there. It scratches the itch. It does set up, you know, the things that you need for everyone to feel good about the fact that we're doing the right thing, we're approaching it in the right way. And then you start the conversation with leaders higher up, saying, okay, this is how you need to engage with the team. These are the kinds of questions that you need to ask. And you kind of start parallel pathing the behavior mm-hmm. with the architecture.
Mm-hmm. I like that. And I what I'm hearing is this heightened focus on the architecture and the behavior piece. I know in past episodes, something I've talked about with other folks too offline, obviously, is culture. It's something yep. that's very easily grasped, but I would also argue that culture is almost a cop-out in some ways. It's this kind of ethereal thing, right? It's, you know, a feeling more than, I think what you're saying around process, around behavior, that's very tactical. And I almost think of the culture as an outcome of doing the first two things. Is that how you see it, or am I not understanding it correctly?
That is 100% how I see it. I think, you know, culture is driven by behavior, by practice, by what you do. And people see what you're doing. They see you doing it repeatedly. So it becomes a habit and an expectation that then fosters beliefs that they have. So if they see you repeatedly investing in innovation and supporting innovation and rewarding things that quote unquote fail, but you learn from, they'll perceive that as, oh, innovation is important. This is a priority. And then you'll start building a culture of innovation. If they see what unfortunately happens at a lot of companies, of all sorts of grand statements about innovation is a priority, and then you hit a downturn and suddenly the innovation team is fired, that's not going to result in a culture of innovation.
Right. And I think when people are excited about stuff, they're very vocal about that stuff. And I think when you're not exhibiting those behaviors or demonstrating that and sending positive signals, I often see, at least in my own experience, it just silences people. And then how do you even build the culture, right, when you're not even aware or people are fearful of even voicing, you know, how things could potentially be improved?
Yeah, spot on. I mean, that's the thing. As a leader, if everything you're talking about is this month, this quarter, you know, the problems we have to solve, the fires we have to put out, that's what people are going to talk about as well.
Yeah. So I guess digging a little bit more into the behaviors, I'm really curious, what are some of those very specific behaviors you try to encourage leaders to take? And I know that looks a little bit differently, so maybe said another way, are there some common biases that you see leaders kind of fall victim to that you help navigate them through?
Yes. So the headline is, you know, I tell leaders, I'm like, do the opposite of your instincts. Which is like the worst advice possible, because that's so hard. They're successful. They're leaders because they have developed the right instincts over time. And to tell them to do the opposite of that, they're going to be like, you've lost your mind. But I haven't yet. So, and the reason I say that is when you're working in the core business, when you're working in operations, you know, that is an environment where you know infinitely more than you don't know. So yes, you absolutely should know the answers to questions, be able to anticipate the problems that could go wrong, predict what's going to happen next, all the things that got you to senior levels. Yes, do that on the operations side of the house. Innovation is totally different. You don't know more than you do know. And so what you need to do as a leader is not come in with all the answers, but come in with really great questions and listen. Yeah. You don't know what's going to happen because you're doing something new. So run little experiments. You know, don't go spend $10 million on something. Figure out how you can spend $10,000 or maybe even $10 to learn a little bit. So innovation is, you know, the exact opposite world in many ways as operations. And so as a leader, you almost, like I said, need to do the opposite of your instincts to succeed in it. But that's really, really hard. So
yeah, that's an interesting paradigm for sure. So who do you find? You mentioned earlier about potentially you see innovation happening in silos and organizations. So I'm curious, you know, as a follow-up, who are you often interfacing with? You know, you just spoke a little bit about operations. Is it the COO? Are you working with the CEO? How do you make sure that, you know, that innovation doesn't, you know, kind of silo itself?
Yeah, it's really working with the business owner. So who has the P&L?
Okay.
And so a lot of times, you know, that may be the CEO, that may be the business unit president, but it really is kind of that business owner, because, and to companies' credits, more and more companies are working in multifunctional teams. So it's not a complete, anathema to say, hey, we need a multifunctional team working on innovation. We need expertise from across the organization to inform this and feed into it. But it really is kind of the business owner that is the critical leader.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when you're forming this team, I suppose, of innovators or entrepreneurs, you know, certainly I can see how obviously it needs to be somewhat cross-functional. Are these people, and maybe your own experience, you know, you said you're at Procter & Gamble, you were assigned to an innovation team, but you were part of the marketing team. Are these innovation teams focused solely on innovation, or do they have like kind of dual roles of like their operational role during the day and then at night they innovate? Like, what's the right mix of that? How do you organize or architect that that team?
Yes, how you architect the team. I am a firm believer, it's one of the hills I will die on, is that they need to be fully dedicated to innovation.
Okay.
And the reason for that is that, you know, just like we talked about, the challenges you face in operations, the way you have to think and problem solve is totally different than in innovation. And just the cognitive load of trying to switch is really hard day to day, let alone from like meeting to meeting. So it's just, I don't think anyone can, nor should they be asked to, constantly make that switch, because it's just, it's too hard. It's too exhausting. I also think that if a company is willing to fully allocate people to innovation, it's a sign that innovation is really a priority. If they're not, and you know, you're doing innovation only in 20% time or 10% time or 15% time, that's a hobby. That's not a priority. And so if companies are like, oh, just do innovation in your spare time, okay, that's a hobby, it's not important. And it will always get overwhelmed by the important things, which are your job.
Right. That makes complete sense. So I'm curious now in identifying this dedicated innovator, if you will, within an organization, how do you? Do you take your A-plus rock star and put them into innovation, or do you keep them on the thing that's paying the bills every month? How do you think about that?
Oh, that's one of the eternal questions. So I think you need at least a team of two people, at least two, because innovation within a successful company is hard. So if nothing else, you need the group therapy dynamic of two people to just kind of support each other and act as like unlicensed therapists. So two people only for mental health reasons. But it also gives you an opportunity to put together a diverse team. So, you know, somebody who's an expert and a generalist, somebody from maybe inside the company and somebody with an outside perspective or at least a broad perspective. I have seen, you know, A-star plus performers come into innovation and really struggle. And it's heartbreaking because here are people who are awesome at what they did in the core business. And a lot of times in companies, there's this perception that like, oh, you have to do a stint in innovation to progress. Because like that shows that you're, you know, you can think and you're strategic and all that stuff. But it's like, if you go into innovation and you are really uncomfortable with ambiguity, if you're really uncomfortable with being uncertain and not knowing, you're going to struggle. And that struggle is going to lead to self-doubt and you're not going to perform well. And suddenly you have this A plus plus performer who doesn't succeed in innovation, completely doubts themselves, and then you're going to chuck them back into the core. It's like, that's just so mean and not fair. So I tend to talk about like, go to the land of misfit toys. Go to the people who are really good, but they don't quite fit. You know, maybe they ask too many questions. Maybe they, you know, are coming up with ideas. So not the people who are, you know, not performing, but the people who aren't quite a perfect fit. Find the misfits. And I say that with love, find the misfits. Those are probably your innovators.
I love that. I think it's all about fit. And, you know, as you're explaining the, you know, taking a rock star and applying them here, it kind of strikes me as a one I guess, outcome of like the Peter principle. You know, you're kind of, you think you're rewarding somebody because they're so successful over in this area and you're putting them over here and they become ineffective, right? So it truly is about knowing the people, what drives them, you know, to your point, it's the misfits is a great signal that, you know, they want to do something differently. They're not conforming, I guess. And that's ultimately maybe in my mind, you know, what embodies an innovator is you got to disrupt the status quo, you know?
Yes. And you need both types of people in your organization. So it's about making sure as a leader that you don't signify that one is more important than the other. You can't have favored children. They're all equal.
Right. I love it. So I guess thinking about innovation more generalized and, you know, maybe another term that people are familiar with is like research and development, maybe in as a way. How should large firms think about research and development and how much to allocate towards that of, you know, time, money, resources, right? Versus small firms, are they equally weighted? You know, how do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's something that's called the golden ratio. And basically it says, you know, in your, regardless of industry, regardless of company type, size, et cetera, 70% of your innovation resources should go to incremental innovation, so improving what you do currently. About 20% should go to adjacent innovation, so, you know, expanding into new markets, new products, new customers, maybe even new business models. And then 10% should be focused on radical innovation. I do think it's a really good starting point. And then layering on top things like, what's going on in your industry? Like, are you in a rapidly changing industry? For example, like, are you in journalism? Are you in media and entertainment? Or are you like one of my previous clients in pumps and compressors? And, you know, you can send the 1974 model to a client to replace the 1952 one that broke, and it's still all good. Industry is changing just at a different pace than media and entertainment.
Sure.
You know, and also layer on, what's the culture of your company? What's the risk tolerance of, you know, the C-suite or the board? But starting with 70-20-10 is a great place to start.
I love that. So I guess one final question to kind of tie this all in a nice bow, and you've had so many good little, like, you know, tips and hints, I think, throughout this conversation. But if you had to boil it down, right, if somebody's out there listening, they're a leader in a business, or maybe they're the CEO and the entrepreneur, and they know something needs to change, what's one piece of advice on just how they might be able to take that first step?
Say what needs to change. Just say it. Just call it out, because I will bet you are not the only person who sees it, but everyone else is too afraid to say it.
Mm.
And so if you're willing, if you're brave enough to say it, it is going to unlock so much. People will start telling you what's wrong, why it's wrong, their ideas to fix it. And, you know, they're not all going to be winners, but the conversation has started. And that's the first step to solving the problem. So if you see something, say something. And that applies to challenges within your organization.
I love it. It's being honest with yourself and humble enough, I guess, to accept that other people might see things a little bit differently, might have a really good idea somewhere in there.
Yes. Yep. Yes. And it's okay to not have the answer. Having a really good question is often actually more impactful and leads to greater success. So, you know, good questions are great.
Absolutely. Well, Robin, I'm sure we could talk for another half hour, another hour.
Yes.
I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. I think there's a lot of substance in here. And I guess just one final, you know, if any of our listeners out there want to keep up with what you're doing, how might they find you?
Yeah, so you can go to my website, milezero, so zero.io. And when you're there, you can sign up to, you can subscribe to my newsletter, just a little article every week. There's also a self-assessment on there for kind of innovation readiness within your organization. You can take that, or there's a button, and I'll send you the link for it as well, that if you click on it, you know, we can talk for 30 minutes. We'll go through your innovation readiness assessment together and have a conversation about how you can be the leader that your organization needs.
Well, that's great, Raman. Thank you so much. And I'll make sure those links are included in the show notes. And I'm sure this won't be the last time we speak. So until we speak again, thank you so much for coming on.
Indeed. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to the Innovation Economy Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please take a minute to subscribe on your podcast channel of choice and leave us a rating so that others can find the show more easily. You can access more episodes at www.innovationeconomy.show or on your podcast platform of choice. The Innovation Economy Podcast was created by The Agile Brand. Be sure to check out the Agile Brand Guide series of books, The Agile Brand Podcast, and other resources for marketing, CX, and other enterprise leaders to manage change and transformation in their organizations. The Innovation Economy is proudly produced by Missing Link, a Latina-owned, strategy-driven, creatively-fueled production co-op. From ideation to creation, they craft human connections through intelligent, engaging, and informative content. Until next time, let's keep innovating.
Agile Brand.